Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Hope you enjoy the long weekend. Remember when we actually had weekends? Remember when you did things over the weekend? This is also kind of screwed up because July 4th is on a Saturday. So do you celebrate it on Monday or did you do it on Friday? Does it really actually matter? I don't know. And of course, at one time, people would go out and have massive parties on July 4th. And I assume in some parts of the country, they're still doing that. The president is flying off to Mount Rushmore for a Patriot-a-palooza. We'll see how that plays out for him. Most of the rest of us probably have to shoot off fireworks in our backyard. I guess they've already started doing that in New York. Joining me on the special July 4th Independence Day weekend version of the Bulwark Podcast, A.B. Stoddard from Real Clear Politics. How are you, A.B.?
I'm feeling patriotic and festive, Charlie.
I wish I did. I usually like fireworks, but here's the big dilemma in our household. It's like, you know, we have a place where there's a lot of fireworks, but we have a new puppy in the house. And he's kind of nervous about it. I don't want to imprint him with fear. He's a German Shepherd, so sooner or later he's going to run to the sound of the guns and everything. But I am going back and forth thinking I really want to see the fireworks, but I don't want to traumatize the dogs. And we have one older dog who used to be just terrified, but now he's basically blind and deaf, so he's chill with everything, which is sort of the good news, bad news.
But this is Charlie. My senior dog is the same way. I'm so glad that he can barely hear the mail come because it used to be a full-scale apocalyptic meltdown. And the fact that he can no longer hear and he only hears sort of two mail arrivals instead of five is an improvement in our lives.
Well, I mean, it used to be that he would be terrified during a thunderstorm, and now it's like, yeah, whatever. You know, can I have a treat? His life is now sort of focused down to dinner, treats, and going to bed. And he's got a very, and he will lobby, you know, as blind and deaf as he is, he will come at a certain time every single day. He will come and start lobbying me that my wife is not making dinner fast enough for him. And he'll stand there. And then of course, when he comes in every time from being outside, he wants a treat and he will insist on the treat. And then at a certain time, very early, you know, very senior citizen time, like around 7:30 or 8, he starts lobbying, looking at me, saying, "You know, are we going to bed now? Can I go? Can we go?
Pete gets what he wants. He's just reached that age, and it's really—it's all about him. This is the salad days. He gets what he wants."
Okay, so speaking of all about him, okay, so since it is Independence Day, Matt Schlapp, who is he still runs CPAC? It's hard for me to know. The oleaginous Matt Schlapp, who's married to Mercedes Schlapp, who's gone completely Trump. And although he's had a terrible week, have you noticed this? That he's kind of the quintessential swamp dweller of the Trump era. And he's been pocketing big checks from a variety of American companies for lobbying. And apparently the only real thing he does is he has access to the White House, and one company after another has been dropping him. Have you seen those stories that Comcast dropped him? I think Abbott Labs dropped him. So he's having a tough day.
I did see that there's reporters obviously who enjoy this, and I think they started poking around to these companies and sort of egging them on. I had not seen any, I saw that last week. I didn't see any updates, but I did notice that Matt's American Conservative Union has endorsed Doug Collins, the congressman from Georgia, over the sitting senator, Kelly Loeffler.
Interesting.
In that jungle primary in Georgia. And that makes things more difficult in Trump world. And it's just a very interesting sort of juicy intra-party fight. So I thought that was interesting. Matt's stepped in there. On behalf of Collins.
The reason I'm bringing up Matt Schlapp, I could be, you know, gratuitous about this, but actually he tweeted out just a little while ago about Independence Day because we all have to celebrate July 4th. So this is his tweet. And this is not a parody. This Saturday, he tweeted, if the Marxist leaders have their way, we will celebrate Independence Day for the last time as a free people. Now is the time to stand up for your country, and even more importantly, pray the great American experiment survives their assault. Wow. That's what President Joe Biden really secretly wants to do. You elect Joe Biden, and we will never, ever celebrate Independence Day again, right?
Yeah, I did see Eric Trump also just tweet, jobs, not mobs. They're just desperate for this culture war that Joe Biden seems unwilling to give them, because they want to pay, because their donors and pollsters are telling them that painting Joe Biden as senile isn't working. Yeah. They need to make him a tool of the radical left and an avowed socialist at heart who's going to pass the Green New Deal and take away your house and give it to, you know, people on welfare, whatever, you know, plans that they have for their advertisements. It's sort of largely, you know, been killed off by the fact that Joe Biden is under fire from liberal groups for not wanting to defund the police and has, you know, discomfort with taking down, you know, some statues. So it's you just see Trump on Twitter and the people around him just itching for this, this culture war and trying to stay on that topic, and whatever skirmishes are happening in the street and CHOP or CHAZ, you know, this type of thing.
Gifts.
All of which Biden has sort of deftly, you know, really avoided. And then when pressed, firmly disassociated, you know, himself enough politically with it, that he can still appeal to all these people in the middle that are giving him, you know, 2 months of incredible, exceeding President Trump's contributions, and then a whole bunch of new donors. So they really need this. Unless they want to take control of the virus, they need Biden to go full AOC, and he's just not playing ball.
Yeah, but this is a messaging problem. He's either a senile, doddering old man, or he's the Emperor Palpatine, or, you know, he's Che Guevara. Right. You do have to choose. Okay, since we're on this, looking back at what a terrible, terrible, ghastly month June was for Donald Trump, and I want to talk about the New York Times story, the sort of deep dive into the panic and weirdness in the White House in Trump world. I don't know whether you caught Donnie Deutsch on MSNBC this morning. This is Friday morning, and he's a regular contributor to Morning Joe. He's a marketing guy, right, Donnie Deutsch? I'm supposed to know more about him, I suppose.
Yes, he is.
Okay, so he makes a prediction about this, and I wanted to bounce you off because this has become kind of a parlor game. So I want to do this right at the top of the podcast. Donnie Deutsch on Morning Joe Friday morning.
I would not be shocked if at some point he drops the mic. This thing is away from him. Oh. It's not turning around. And this is a guy that I cannot see standing up and owning the biggest landslide defeat in U.S. history. So I know you've been throwing it out there, and a lot of people saying it's that's not possible. The more I think about it, the more I'm jumping on your bandwagon. I don't see this guy going the distance.
Okay, so I tweeted out, this is not going to happen. No way Donald Trump is leaving the race. But, hey, since we have a long weekend, we might as well talk about it. So,
well, Donnie is not alone. I was fascinated to see about a week ago that Charlie Gasparino of Fox News, he's on Fox Business pretty regularly, said that he had high-level sources saying that they're going to have to convince him to walk away so they can replace him on the ticket if things continue. Now, it's really hard to see the man that has presented himself with all his fully revealed id through Twitter and everything he's ever said to us walking away and quitting. But the interesting thing would be if you ever saw the Republicans walk away from him, like on the Russia bounty story, right? If all of a sudden they turned on him and they made it so much harder for him and they didn't back him and they said, this is, you know, impossible, this is to defend, and really went after him, it would be hard for him, I think it would be really hard for him. Look, it looks right now like it's hard for him to win, right? But the truth is we don't really know who's going to vote because
but
we're in the middle of a pandemic.
But does he think that, though? I mean, this guy is capable of bullshitting himself, right? I mean, he engages in magical thinking. And I thought one of the interesting things about the New York Times article was that even though you have big donors who are warning him, you have to do something, you have to change course, you know, you are losing this thing, that you have people on his staff who basically sit around, how can we make him feel better about himself? Let's massage the polls in such a way that he thinks that he's actually winning, that he's going to win in Maine where he's not going to win. So he's created his own little echo chamber around him of people who are not going to give him the bad news. Plus, he's Donald Trump, and Donald Trump remembers the Access Hollywood weekend, and I just don't see the guy's ego letting him bail on this. Of course, the counterargument is that his ego won't let him lose by a landslide. So I don't know. I think this is a lot of wishful thinking.
I think it is true. I mean, obviously, Republicans would love it, Charlie, if Mike Pence could run with Nikki Haley and save them from this, you know, potential Biden landslide and on and on, but it's really hard to see Trump walking away, and it's hard to see him accepting that he's losing it, because as you mentioned, we continue to see all this anecdotal reporting that he can't even see polling that shows him losing. And someone who worked in the White House told me a year ago that he didn't work there anymore, but he had. Closely around the president, who told me that there was no way he would leave if he lost it, because he doesn't believe that he's ever lost anything. Everything is through the prism of winning and losing.
Right.
So he can't come out yesterday and tout good jobs report news and then empathize with people who've been affected by the virus. Hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Americans, of families, you know, people who've lost friends or loved ones. It's only positive news about the economy. There's no gray matter. There's no texture. There's no conflict, nothing. It's all winning or losing. And so it is really hard to see him, you know, just accepting, like, I'm headed for a loss. I can't, you know, find any hydroxychloroquine for this. There's no magical cure. And I better bail. He doesn't care about the Senate majority. He never has.
He
thinks he can overwhelm the polls and the odds, because as I reminded, because I was just almost at the end of Tim Alberta's book, you know, there was really solid leads in those key states in the Rust Belt for Hillary close to the end, you know, 6 and 5. And he thinks there's a secret Trump voter that doesn't show pollsters that they love him. And so I can't imagine that his state of mind has changed from that at all.
No, I can't either. On the other hand, you know, there's no way he's going. I did though find it very revealing this week, and I had put it in my newsletter on Friday, the fact that he's now had two chances to come up with a second term agenda, and he blew both of them. I mean, he had the ultimate softball question from Sean Hannity, and he answered with that weird word salad, and then because everybody realized that was kind of embarrassing. You know, somebody even more sycophantic than Sean Hannity, if that's possible,
Eric Bowling.
Yeah, gave him a chance to do a do-over, and he still can't come up with anything that he will do in the second term, other than, you know, talking about what he's done and how great he's made America. You know, he can't really promise I'm going to bring more jobs back, because he's always brought them back. I mean, he's done all of this, which does. It goes to this question of the incredible disconnect between Donald Trump, who is the president, but who doesn't want to do the job of being president, that he really doesn't have any ideas. There's no plan. There's no vision. There's no platform. He's going to run about the monuments. He's going to run against Antifa, caravan judges, Hunter Biden, you know, warning about Marxists and everything. But he's got no plan. He's got no ideas. He's completely disconnected from the day-to-day role of governing, which of course brings us to this moment we're in right now, where we've seen him fail at performing his most basic duties, from reading the daily brief to getting his handle on coronavirus to finding some way of dealing with the racial divide in this country. I mean, it is a really remarkable moment he finds himself in right now. So you had a piece this week where you ask the question, will President Trump hear the Republican cries for help? Before we answer that question, tell me what these cries for help are and where they're coming from. What are you hearing from Republicans? What is their level of panic at the moment?
Well, it's so interesting. They also have begun, I noticed there was far more, and you probably have experienced this too, Charlie, far more stark reality in early 2017 at the sort of the shock that the president wasn't adjusting in April, then August, then November to the job of presidenting and, you know, a little tisking and then a little panic a year later after the trade war was begun and some, you know, things were real getting crazy and you had a midterm election on the horizon and the man was trying to shut down the government, close the border to Mexico, declare a national, you know, all this stuff is always, it's always prompted more, you know, kind of clarity than I'm finding in 2020. It's really interesting that Republicans, when you talk to them privately, are still, they know that he has not met this moment, that he pressed with a crisis when it wasn't about his grievances or what he found on TV Newser about Chris Cuomo's primetime ratings on CNN. He doesn't want to do the job and he's found it a real grind and he just likes to throw things in the air and light them on fire and put on shows. That they've finally been faced with the looming threat that everyone like us always talked about, which was a real governing crisis will happen and he will show his true colors, not just to you guys who have known this all along, but to Americans who don't follow the news and are not politically active and are not MAGA or not Democrats. They just are disconnected from this process. They're disenchanted by it. And all of a sudden there's a massive crisis in which they have to pay attention to the news every day, which is the pandemic. And they learn that the government is out at sea. It's not taking it seriously and is complicit in making it worse. So you talk to these guys and they say, well, the economy still could bounce back. Biden is a weak candidate when he comes out of the basement. But then what you see publicly, which is why I wrote the column, because I was so startled that they were saying it publicly, is comments from senators about how he might think about turning things around and talking in a more unifying way and talking about policy instead of your personality and making it about substance instead of style. And all of a sudden, I mean, this is what they do to, you know, to break through the television. And I, on Sunday morning, I was the most startled to see that Lamar Alexander, the Senate Help Committee chairman, who avoids talking about Donald Trump and being interviewed like it's a full-time job, calls into CNN to do this, you know, this pro-mask PSA. Because the senator, knowing that they would make him, you know, run through all the times Trump has denied it or suggested, you know, Lysol lemonade or whatever goes on. And he did it anyway because they've all gotten together and said, no mask, no economy. They've known no mask, no economy for months. We have no economy unless we wear masks. And so it was such an emergency that they all decided last Friday that they would go on this mask brigade. And so it's a desperate cry for help that they're doing, you know, through the media to try to get his people to say, look, these, you know, these are your lieutenants. They're really panicked. You got to wear a mask. You've got to change your message. You've got to stop stepping on rakes. And I don't think he's going to hear their cries for help, but it was worth documenting all of them.
Right. Well, Chuck Grassley, those tweets were remarkable.
I know. He can't stop. And he's mad at Fox News for not, you know, getting the president into shape and helping him answer the question about the agenda for the next 4 years.
Well, it was also interesting. He said, is anybody with access to the White House, you know, tell them that they need to do blank, blank, blank. You're a senior Republican United States senator. And you're saying, hey, is there anybody that like they'll actually listen to who understands that this is not helping, that you're losing this? Interesting quote in that New York Times article by Senator John Thune. Is he like number three?
I think he's number two now.
Number two. He says, sometimes you get dealt a hand and you got to play it. And I had two reactions to that, of course, which is, you know, the Kenny Rogers, you know, where you got to know when to hold them and know when to fold them and when to walk away, all that stuff. On the other hand, you know, they weren't dealt a hand. They made a choice, didn't they? I mean, all of them, they're sitting there going, well, we got dealt this terrible hand. No, you dealt the hand to yourself. you made this choice. And wasn't it Thune who was quoted a few months ago basically saying, yeah, we basically are in with Trump, you know, we're going to rise with him or fall with him, but we're all in.
Yes, he said our fortunes are tied.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we're not going to break with him. We're not going to criticize him. We're not going to investigate him. We're just going to roll over. And here we are in July. And, you know, they're stuck.
What's so interesting, Charlie, is that when a few months ago, when that 57 page memo from the NRSC, the National Republican Senatorial Committee that runs the senators' campaigns and are trying to protect these 23 senators, 10 of whom are really costly races from toss up down to, you know, no longer safe and only lean Republican, this type of thing. They said never defend the administration's COVID response, just talk about China. And then the administration got mad and they were scolded and then they had to take it back. But in that initial wave, former Republican member from Virginia, who's sort of a map master and also once ran the NRCC, Tom Davis, said at some point to hold the Senate majority, the senators will have to say we have to be a check on Biden and you'll need us in the Senate. You'll need divided government to run away from Trump and just admit to try to hold on to their jobs. And they were told, no, you're not allowed to depart from the president in any way. Now, what's interesting about the fresh reporting from the last couple of days is that, you know, we're being told that, oh, the Senator Ernst campaign is upset with the president. And, oh, maybe McConnell will advise them after Labor Day to cut bait. I mean, it sounds like they'll have to, right? At some point, if they want to save the majority and they know that the president is entirely disinterested in preserving the Senate majority, he just thinks it's about the White House and him and not about the Republican agenda or justices or anything, right? He's just tunnel vision on his own race. It makes sense that they would have to cut bait, but it still seems like a daunting task, right? Because you get the mean tweet and you get death threats at your campaign office and on and on.
I just think that it's too late. They're in too deep. But you did say something that was very intriguing earlier, right near the beginning of the podcast, where you mentioned the whole Russian bounty for killing American soldiers in Afghanistan. If there's ever a moment at which you would have Republicans who would distance themselves from the White House, this might be it.
Right.
Will they do it? Or will it be the same old story that we've seen? Will it be senatorial Groundhog Day again, even on this issue?
Charlie, I saw some initial from Todd Young of Indiana. I saw some initial, fortitude, I guess, coming out of the Republican side on this. And then it just seems to have gone quiet. Why is the process argument, let's blame the briefer who didn't sing it in a musical country song version for the president. All these two steps the White House is doing, not saying that the president's going to respond to this horrible policy, you know, substantive development, national security threat and threat to our men and women in uniform, a violation of his oath, everything. I mean, just only talking about the process of who, when the briefing happened this way or that and whose fault it was. Yeah. The fact that the senators have been so quiet, I really thought last week that was, you know, their chance to stand up and say, this is wrong. We do confront the Russians. This is an outrage. And there was a little bit, and then it just seemed to have disappeared. Like they're hoping that the process stuff and other, you know, calamitous news controversies will just give them another week's time or something. It's worked
in the past. Although I do think that as the drip, drip, drip of details comes out, the Trump position that it's all a hoax becomes a much more difficult position to defend. But I don't know. I guess I'm old enough to remember when Congress actually did some active oversight, when you might have actually had hearings. But that seems like a distant time now, doesn't it?
Of course. It's such a scandal. And the problem is, for Republicans, it's so easy for Americans to understand this one, that after all these stories, they realize he really likes Putin. Wow. People are upset about this because they believe that it's real and the intelligence is good. And then it goes back a really long time. And we have these certain dates where we know he was briefed and he's playing dumb. And it's just, I just don't understand why Republicans would want to be, you know, taken down by that. And just looking at it in terms of purely political, in a purely political prism, the president depends on a fragile coalition, as we've talked about before. And if he loses seniors and he loses non-college white women and he loses a whole bunch of veterans and active duty military, he's not going to win.
No, that would seem obvious. No, I could see that at some point I can understand why Republicans might want to keep their heads down right now. But if more information comes out, this would be the issue that I think they would have cover to break with him, at least somewhat. Okay, let's talk about what's going on inside this campaign, this New York Times story, which just shows the divisions within the campaign, the scrambling, the butt covering, the turf warfare. And it all seems to center on the question of Jared Kushner, who on the one hand appears to be the guy calling the shots. On the other hand, was the subject of that Axios article where Trump said, yeah, I'm sorry, I listened to him on things like criminal justice reform. So talk to me about what is Jared Kushner's role here?
So the reason that the New York Times reporting was so much fun was because it really was the most detailed picture that we've seen in a long time of how sort of nuts Jared is. I mean, we know he has no political sense and we know he's corrupt, but the idea that he tells a bunch of people that he wants them to say good things about Brad Parscale, the campaign manager, to the president to keep him calm. Then he berates Brad Parscale himself and then criticizes Brad to other people at the same time. I mean, he doesn't know if he's coming or going. I never wanted him ordering ventilators or syringes or test vials or anything, but this is really hilarious. This idea that just like his father-in-law, he changes his mind every 4 hours and can't stay, you know, on one position about who's going to lead and who's going to be his deputy. The bottom line is that Jared has always run this government since the beginning of the transition. Everyone can pretend that Mike Pence has this responsibility or Donald Trump makes this final decision, or sometimes even Ivanka gets to play senior advisor or junior president or secretary of state. But Jared Kushner runs this government. He is in a higher position of deferred and sort of default, just given authority than anybody on any issue. Pompeo, Pence, the president, anybody, and chief of staff. No one's ever been a real chief of staff. It's always been Jared Kushner. And so occasionally people like this Bernard Marcus, the co-founder of Home Depot, who had dinner with President Trump last Saturday and is in the lead of this New York Times piece last night, saying, I think your polling is terrible and I don't trust Jared Kushner. And then Trump will dump on Jared and say, you're right, but don't worry, we're bringing in like other smarter people. But no one is dumping Jared Kushner. What you can be sure of today is that Jared Kushner will continue to run this campaign. Other people will come out in and out of the circle and be fired and hired and fired and hired and given certain titles and then be a lot of drama. But Jared Kushner is the final wall. No one breaches that. That doesn't change. And it's why, you know, you saw Tucker Carlson go directly after him a few weeks ago, basically saying that the president shouldn't listen to Jared Kushner. And it's because he thinks that Jared Kushner runs the country. What Tucker's, you know, what he probably knows, but his monologues, you know, made it seem like he's wrong about, is that Trump can't quit Jared. Jared reads things for him. He thinks for him. He makes decisions for him.
On the outside, Jared Kushner seems to be the symbol of arrogant, incompetent nepotism. The president listens to people like Tucker Carlson. He, you know, tells people that he's mad at Jared for giving him advice on criminal justice reform because, you know, woke Jared.
Right.
But what is the secret sauce here? What is Jared's hold over Donald Trump?
He believes that Jared's loyal because he's married to Ivanka and Jared can't leave him. I mean, first of all, he can't fire Jared because Ivanka is his favorite relative, but also he genuinely trusts only them. He only trusts them. He doesn't trust anybody else.
That's not changing. See, that's the terrifying thing, I think, for a lot of Republicans, is to think, okay, you have a campaign in crisis. Normally, when a campaign is in crisis, you bring in really top-notch, smart, experienced people. But the problem is Trump can't do that. He's not going to bring in anybody outside this narrow circle. And he's surrounded himself with some deeply incompetent people. And I want to get to Eric Trump in a moment. this inner circle is, I mean, that's, you want to talk about a clown car?
It's really, I mean, I'm sorry, Charlie, but it's truly beyond belief. Because the only thing that's going to change, and this is my first thought after finishing the piece last night in New York Times, was the only thing that'll change is maybe he'll let Dave Bossie and Corey Lewandowski come back in and sort of have some prominent, you know, other titles. But it doesn't matter how frustrated Mark Meadows is as chief of staff. It doesn't matter how, you know, whether Brad Parscale is doing this or that, or Don Jr.'s weighing in, or Tucker saying this in his monologue at night, or what the president's telling the donors. It's always just run by Jared Kushner and Ivanka, and they cannot be fired.
And they cannot be fired. Anyone in business, anyone who has run something knows that that is the most dangerous position to be in, to have the son-in-law, the daughter, the wife, the deeply incompetent person in a crucial role, and you know that no matter how badly they screw the pooch, they're not going anywhere.
And that's why I'm so sick of reading these accounts about, you know, this person turning to someone who, like, Mick Mulvaney has to hear whining from Mark Meadows about, you didn't tell me. Everyone's known from day one that Jared Kushner ran the country. Every Republican congressman, every Republican senator, they all know this. It doesn't change. And he works on the campaign from the White House. He works leading the country from the campaign. It's all overlapping. It's all illegal. It doesn't matter. It's nothing. None of that will change.
Okay, this is my head hitting the desk again. You know, I have so many bad memories of 2016. They're hard to sort out. But one that really stuck in my mind was the Republican convention in Cleveland. And I was actually there. You were there, right?
Yes.
In Cleveland.
That's where we met, actually, yeah. Charlie.
And, yeah, exactly. And I remember there was a point at which I think people in the media or the punditocracy wanted to find something good to say about Donald Trump. I mean, they wanted to find some positive thing. And to remember all of the commentary, about, well, at least he has great kids.
Right.
I mean, they are really impressive. So, you know, you may not like his politics, but obviously Donald Trump was a great dad, because otherwise you wouldn't have people turn out as great as Don Jr. Yeah. and Eric Trump. And wow, you want to talk about takes that did not age well. And where I'm going on this is the danger of the president surrounding himself with some really, I'm sorry, just dumb people. Eric Trump. Eric Trump tweets out a picture. I am going to get to the. Is it, yeah, you pronounce her name Ghislaine Maxwell.
The French pronunciation is Ghislaine, but I don't know that she even uses that. No. She's a Brit. I'm not actually an expert on that whole posse of criminals.
Okay. Well, you know, this is of course, you know, Epstein's fixer, and she just got arrested, and of course, all the QAnon people are going crazy about all of this, you know, sex trafficking and whatnot. And a lot of people in public life who are very, very nervous because she knows
Charlie,
everything.
I'm worried about her being suicided in prison myself.
Did you see the New York Post cover? On this was a keep her alive. Now keep her alive. Like, oh my goodness, this is getting serious.
So Bill Barr's Justice Department allowed Jeffrey Epstein somehow to die by suicide. And I think the DOJ has that on their record. So I hope they will make sure that all of the all-night cameras are on and the guards are awake. And Ms. Maxwell is not allowed to take her life before she testifies.
You know, I know some people may think this is tabloid journalism here, but you have to at least, you know, sort of look over your shoulder and think, what does she know? What is she going to say? And what are the possible political implications for a lot of prominent people from all of that? So just in case you thought the 2020 couldn't get any wilder and weirder. But the reason I brought this up was this Eric Trump tweet where he takes a picture from Chelsea Clinton's wedding. Okay, so first of all, you know, and then Bill Clinton is walking his daughter down the aisle, or walking arm in arm, and Ms. Maxwell is in the crowd, and he circles her face and says, "Birds of a feather." And then everybody pointed out, Eric, how dumb is this, considering that there are about a gazillion pictures of your dad, Don Sr., with Jeffrey Epstein? I mean, they palled around together. And so that, of course, exploded on Twitter, and Eric Trump or somebody, quickly deleted it. But it was one of those, what were you even thinking? What world do you live in to think that you're going to score some points with a picture of Bill Clinton with, Ghislaine, whatever her name is, Maxwell, off in the corner, when there are all sorts of pictures of Donald Trump with Jeffrey Epstein? So just from the point of view, without getting into any of the sex trafficking stuff or any of that stuff, just how dumb this inner circle is. And so for people, waiting for the pivot or waiting for the great mind, waiting for the James Bakers of the world to come in and say, okay, this is the way we're going to do it. Or, Karl Rove's going to come in and come up with a whiteboard for how we're going to turn this around. That's just not going to happen,
people. Yeah. The Eric Trump, just to amuse you, Charlie, I had seen all the pictures on Twitter of Ghislaine Maxwell next to the Trump couple before I saw Eric Trump's tweet, which made it even better. But obviously it wasn't even Joe Biden with Ghislaine Maxwell. So the whole thing was so lame. But I thought that Karl Rove's column on this topic was particularly interesting because he really obviously went out of his way to try to make it sound like there was still great hope for this turnaround. And he actually provided all of these, policy prescriptions, things he could be talking about that would really energize his populist base. And again, none of which, Trump is not interested in talking about infrastructure right now. He wants to talk about how he's doing great deals on trade with President Xi, but he knows he's not allowed to. So he's just gone mute and he only talks about TV ratings and grievances. And so it's just so interesting to see. A, he's not going to bring anyone like a Karl Rove into a serious position anyway in the campaign. But these sort of cries for help, these loving suggestions from Chuck Grassley and everything, they're not going to penetrate the inner circle that's running the show.
Well, I think at some point, if the pattern holds, somebody will write up a speech for him with some of these ideas and he will read the speech. And there'll be 18 hours of media coverage saying, well, this is the Trump campaign reset. This is 2.0. And then, of course, it'll be forgotten in 1.5 news cycles. He'll go back to tweeting because that's the way it always is. So speaking of the next big inflection point in the campaign, the Republican National Convention in Jacksonville. How is this playing out? You wrote actually a prescient column about the Tulsa rally, asking whether it was as dumb as it looked. Actually, it turned out to be even dumber, right? So the rally was a fiasco. It's continuing to look like a fiasco. President is having to dial down a lot of these things. But the big one is the convention in Jacksonville, which he moved there from Charlotte. But is that going to go ahead? So Jacksonville has just mandated the use of masks. Are they going to, and Jacksonville is turning out to be a coronavirus hotspot. What are you hearing? Anything?
This is an incredible mess because unless you saw the RNC suddenly tweet out, we're so excited to all wear our masks and sit with each other every other seat or outdoors in Jacksonville in the 102 degree weather, I can't imagine that they can actually do this. I mean, you have, all these infections from the Tulsa rally, including Herman Cain, who's 74, who's in the hospital, who's sitting in the crowd with no mask on, photographed there. You have people, public health officials in Texas and Florida, and California and Arizona acknowledging that indoor, any indoor, you know, gathering is dangerous, from bars to obviously a huge arena. We're going to see this event in South Dakota without masks and social distancing, but that's outside. The idea of jamming people into a stadium as the virus rages between now and August 24th or whatever, and not make them follow extreme protocols, which would actually just, we can't even imagine what those would even be, because it would never be safe, right? Let alone what Trump could stomach. I just think they have to find a way to move something outside or cancel it. And it's just, it's all over. But, you know, Trump's pouting. We're just waiting to hear how he wants to message it. But you look at Florida, it's now the number one as of today, I guess percentage wise, increase in cases. It's the positivity rates. It's completely out of control. And there was even recent polling, Charlie, which I'm sure you saw, of Duval County, where 70% of the residents didn't want the convention to happen there.
Well, about the only thing that I think that he can do is, as you point out, is to move it outside. But even that doesn't really solve the problem. And this is, this is the nightmare scenario for the Trump campaign, is that the signature part of their campaign has become so problematic. Really interesting that they didn't see the Tulsa thing happening at all, which, I mean, that's got to be, that has to have rattled them a lot. They've demoted one guy who basically became the scapegoat. But how does Brad Parscale, how does he survive something like that?
So I have some people who, I don't know if I've mentioned this before on your show, but I have some people that are upset about Brad Parscale, and they email me and they try to get me to, poke around on it, but it's all been out there, right? That Brad's enriching himself. And then there's reports that, he's been tight with Jared. That was always the line until recently, until the Tulsa rally, actually. And that he is involved with paying Lara Trump, Eric's wife, and Kimberly Guilfoyle in some way where they're making a very nice living as campaign surrogates, that would be questionable otherwise.
So the wives and the girlfriends are on Brad Parscale's page.
Yeah, I think.
I am sure glad they.
You know what,
that
Charlie?
Swamp.
It makes me think actually of all these people that we've been sort of laughing at. Maybe Brad is smarter than we thought, right? If you pay the women, you keep your job.
Hmm. Yeah, he figured it out. Maybe he did figure it out.
I mean, so that's. But yeah, this idea that, as we know, the idea is that Trump comes up with a stupid idea that he's adamant about. No one can talk him down from it. No one can tell him it's going to be a bummer. They all ride the wave of denial. And then when it ends, somebody has to be blamed. So it is, I know that one guy is gone, but it will be interesting if Brad Parscale if he does retain his position, then who would be the fall guy for in the next planned event, which is the convention? I mean, you can't, Trump can never actually just say, yes, we're endangering people. So someone has to take some kind of fall. But this magical thinking thing it's one thing. The world between Tulsa then and, you know, Jacksonville, third week in August, is not possible to realize this fantasy.
No, see, that's what's so interesting is you realize all the things that could go wrong. And the stories about the Secret Service agents who have contracted the coronavirus, or even the advanced people. You had the story this week that Mike Pence had to delay his visit to Arizona because some of the Secret Service agents had tested positive. So, I mean, there are so many layers of problems here. And of course, the president thinks he had a good day yesterday with those new jobs numbers showing that the economy added more than 4 million jobs. And so, you know, if you go on Twitter, you'll see the Republicans spiking the football, which again is one of those moments where you go, just wait a little bit. I mean, this is I am surprised by the number of pundits who, you know, immediately rush to say, where does Ron DeSantis go to get his apology, since obviously he handled Florida so well? Wait to see how it plays out. All the people are saying, well, the jobs are coming back, the economy is coming back. Well, wait a month, because those numbers don't really reflect this resurgence of the virus around the country. And yet everybody has to have the, you know, the hot take before you actually know how it plays out.
Charlie, not only that, there's the Federal Reserve chairman told us that pandemic level unemployment will continue for years, and that he sees by 2022 still over 5%, and that we're going to end the year more like 9.5%. Of course, Trump tweeted something to trash him and say he's always wrong, and Trump feels more optimistic. But I haven't seen Jay Powell revise his assessment. I mean, we know that state and local governments are drowning. They're going to have to lay off a bunch of middle-class workers, teachers, firefighters, cops, nurses, you know, sanitation workers, if they don't get more aid from Congress. And you know, we also, of course, are looking at, you know, those numbers frozen in early June before we really got to this new, not second wave of the virus, but continuation of the first wave because of the strong level of denial in this country. We're not yet, as you said, at a place where we can see the consequences of those spikes. I mean, all of those indoor bars had to close. The beaches are closed this weekend in those three states, and also, I guess, including California. So we have no idea what August looks like, what September, October looks like. And while the president is always promising that, well, we're going to have a fantastic third quarter, even better fourth quarter next year, the best year ever, I don't think that Tom Tillis or someone in a tough race should gaslight the American public on how overpromise on the economy. I mean, it would be great if it saved them come, you know, good news came in late September and promises of a vaccine soon. But, you know, I think it to overpromise and to look like you're completely out of it is more politically injurious than to just sort of hope that, you know, the tide changes by early October.
Well, you know, this again is the alternative reality that Trump lives in, where, you know, he had convinced himself that if you prioritize the economy over the coronavirus, that it would somehow just disappear. Speaking of remarkable things that he said, I don't know whether you saw the you went through the same process when the president said, it was just yesterday or the day before, that the coronavirus is just going to disappear. I thought, well, when did he say that? Was that back in April? Was that
same reaction
back in March? I actually had to go through it and go through and go, wait, no, he just said that this week. I mean, the day that we were setting the record number of infections, that day that we broke 50,000, there is the president. And boy, you know, I know we've had presidents who've circled the wagons and had credibility gaps, but that was even by Trump standards, that was a pretty amazing moment of disconnect with reality. Now, I know we beat up on Republicans a lot on this podcast, but I have to say, I was surprised that the Texas Governor Greg Abbott was willing to completely reverse himself, particularly in the current environment, to say, yeah, I made a mistake by reopening, and now we're going to start to reclose the state. That was a pretty gutsy move on Abbott's part, and you know that he's getting a whole bunch of flack from the Trumpian right down
yeah.
in Texas.
Oh, yeah, and you can see the difference, the contrast between Ron DeSantis' defiance as governor of Florida compared to Governor Abbott bending to reality, which is that, you know, he's now obviously frightened for his state. And yes, he will catch some grief. But I have to pile on Republicans on your podcast, because why is it so hard for Lamar Alexander to have said last night, actually, it's not going to go away? Why is it hard for people to just say, no, we've actually heard this for 5 months and it's never gone away. And so we're not going to use words like it's going away, because we need to protect our people. And it just is so, it's so bizarre to me that he is still talking like a crazy person, and they're not, and they're not saying, actually, no, you know, let's all, you know, take our precautions. And it's just the thing about Trump that they know is that Trump's treating the virus like Stormy Daniels. So every time he has made a huge calamitous mess, he's just created another one 5 minutes later to make sure that we take our eyes off the first one and we go to the next one, which is like more toxic and more stinky and more horrifying. And you can't take your eyes off of it. And so he can't make Americans take their eye off the ball of a pandemic. They are living hand to mouth, or they've lost their job, or they've lost their health insurance, or they have underlying conditions, or they have a family member they're worried about, or their kids are not going to go to school in the fall. And they will not take their eye off of this crisis. And so he continues to, you know, as you know, gaslight us on it. But I think it's far too late for Republicans to play along. It's not the end of March. You know, it's just ridiculous that they wouldn't just step up like Governor Abbott and say, okay, I think we've got to change the course we're on.
Yeah, the clock continues to run. And this is a point that Jonathan Last has made several times, that, you know, we keep thinking that November is a long time away and it will feel like 1,000 days from now. But the reality is that the window for turning things around is much narrower than I think people realize. A.B. Stoddard, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast and helping us get through a long
Independence Day weekend. It's always a ball to be with you, Charlie. Thanks so much. Happy July 4th.
And thank you all for listening to this weekend's Bulwark podcast. I hope you have a great Independence Day. I hope you stay safe. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back next week, and we'll do this all over again.